You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Conductor Robert Spano is backstage at Lyric.
I think what's so profound and important about this opera is the opportunity to contemplate our human situation in a world where we live with the ever-present possibility of nuclear disaster and Holocaust.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'm pleased to introduce this episode on Dr. Atomic. Your host is Wynn Delacoma, currently an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. She's also former music critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. Wynn is interviewing a number of fascinating people associated with our production of Dr. Atomic. She's already spoken to the celebrated director librettist Peter Sellers. You can download that interview on our website by scrolling down to episode number 5. For this edition, Wynn is talking to conductor Robert Spano, the brilliant music director of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra, who's led innumerable major orchestras around the world. Before we play the interview, here's a brief synopsis of the opera. The characters in this opera are real, as are the consequences brought about by the development of the atomic bomb. We're at the Manhattan Project Laboratory at Los Alamos, New Mexico, in June 1945, as work on the atomic bomb approaches its culminating point. Physicists under the project's scientific director, J. Robert Oppenheimer, plus engineers and U.S. military personnel labor under intense pressure from Washington to have the bomb tested and ready for use within the next month. General Leslie Groves, military commander for the project, is aware of Oppenheimer's troubling past involvements with the Communist Party. He has, up to now, been able to persuade the government to look the other way because of Oppenheimer's great value to the program. The opera also centers on Kitty Oppenheimer, Robert's wife, and her anxiety over the project. This is set against tensions between the project's key players. Act 1 takes place about a month before the bomb is to be tested. Act 2 is set the morning of July 15, 1945, the day of the test. During Act 2, time frequently slows down for the characters and then snaps back into reality. The opera ends in the final, prolonged moment before the bomb is detonated. Now, on to the interview with Wynn Delacoma and Robert Spano. I hope you enjoy it.
Mr. Spano, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure.
I know you are certainly no stranger to Lyric. I remember a very memorable Ariadne.
Was a wonderful experience for me.
In 1998, I think, but I also remember a memorable evening at Ravinia when you conducted John Adams' El Niño.
Oh, yes.
With your Atlanta Symphony. Tell me a bit about your involvement with Adams' music. When did you first hear him? How did you respond?
I was a composer as a child, and I went to conservatory as a composer, and I was studying from the time I was about 14, I guess. And I had a wonderful teacher, Raymond Zupko, who taught at Western Michigan University in Kalamazoo. And I was very much influenced by the big names of the day, Stockhausen and Boulez and Berlioz. And I was experimenting with writing music much like theirs. And then I heard Harmony Lyra of John Adams right after it was recorded.
A little different than Stockhausen.
It was exhilarating and it was liberating, and it was this, starting with that E minor triad, which was a watershed for him too in his own work, he so states himself, but then it was a revelation for me. So he was a huge influence. He gave me permission to write triads.
I was going to say, what was it that he really sort of gave you permission to do? What was exciting that it was so different from what you had been studying?
Yes, absolutely. And I think the other liberating thing for me about Harmony Lyra in particular are the long lines, the incredible melodic shape and sense, and it's really comes from Sibelius in many ways. And so it was a wonderful, powerful experience.
Have you conducted much of his music?
Yes, I've done Harmony Lehrer many, many times. I've done Nixon in China, Death of Klinghoffer.
Where did you
El
do
Nino.
Those?
Nixon in China and Klinghoffer we did at BAM mm-hmm. in New York. And El Nino we did in Atlanta, and then we brought it here to Ravinia.
Right.
I've also done his Shaker Loops and his Chamber Symphony, and he's a long-standing friend of my musical life.
Now, let me ask you about Dr. Atomic. This is the first time you're conducting it. Is that,
yes.
is that right?
Right.
And tell me about its challenges. How might it be different, say, from his other operas, or how is it similar, and what are the challenges?
I think what I find most fascinating about this particular score in John's output is he's still creating, if you know Nixon, it's those kinds of rhythmic grooves, those rhythmic machines he sets up. And he's still creating many of those in Dr. Atomic, but they're dislocated, they're off balance. And the score seems to me to be a study in all the ways you can create tension. and
appropriate for the topic.
Exactly. And so the sense of expectation that this bomb is going to go off is omnipresent, I find, in the score. One of the ways he achieves that is this rhythmic instability, that the machines have gone awry, in a sense. And so the challenge, I find, is that you still need to have those machines work and be functioning properly. But then when you get it all correct, the effect is one of a disequilibrium.
It's interesting because you certainly can't have this is not a short opera, so you certainly No. can't have unresolved tension for 3 hours or whatever it is. How do you pace the flow of the opera?
Well, I think John paced it wonderfully because there are respites, especially the scenes with Kitty, Oppenheimer's wife. Those are wonderfully luscious. There's Act 1, Scene 2's text even has allusions to her hair, often in Oppenheimer's words, and it reminds me so much of Pelléas, and musically it reminds me of Debussy, much of the lush textures that are in that scene, and then to have the hair poetically mentioned in that way too it takes me right to that sound world, and I think those kinds of moments that John creates that are relief from the tension, make the opera take on a shape that's not just waiting for the bomb.
I understand that this is terribly difficult in terms of the musicians. It's a very, very difficult score. How are you working with the lyric musicians on that? And
well, I haven't met with the orchestra yet.
Mm-hmm.
I will soon. And what I have been deeply impressed by is the level of performance of the chorus. The rehearsals we've had on this music, which is extremely difficult, they're just eating it up. They're in complete command of it. It's really exciting.
Tell me a little bit about what the chorus's role is in this opera. Who do they tend to be?
They're us. The chorus really represents the citizenry. It's meant to be the voice of all of us. Mm-hmm. And Peter Sellers said a beautiful thing to the chorus about their role, in that he said that the virtue and power of a democracy takes effort on the part of every individual, and that we have to contribute to its working rather than have democracy be something that just happens. It actually requires our participation in the governing of our own lives, and it's a beautiful idea. And the chorus very much speaks the voice of questioning if this is really the right thing to do, and if we should be going ahead.
Which was indeed the issue for a number of people of the real live people who were working on that project.
Exactly. And the scientists, there's a fantastic book, and I can't remember the title, that was published in 1946, and it's just been reissued. Oh, I wish I could remember the name. It was a plea to stop the arms race. Already they saw it coming. So it was it is true, I think, that the world has never been the same. I think that the devastation of that bomb in Hiroshima and I don't think it's possible to overestimate the impact that's had on the globe.
On one hand, the sense is that, oh, well, opera really should not be about current events. I know the one complaint that has sometimes been made at that with John Adams, these are CNN operas, you know, they're lifted out of the headlines. What do you think about that? Do you think that's a valid criticism?
I think of it as high praise rather than criticism. They are CNN operas in that sense. They are taken out of the headlines. They are relevant to our world, to our issues, to our concerns. And they speak to difficult issues in our lives, because each of them, Nixon in China and death of Klinghoffer, these are complex scenarios that he's engaging and giving us an opportunity to wrestle with it as an audience. And I think this is no different. Peter said another wonderful thing to the chorus the other day, that opera is the last refuge of things that are too long. In a good way. Well, because it's not a soundbite. It's an opportunity really to contemplate, and not just to have a first or second thought about this situation, but to have a ninth and a tenth thought, and to really stay with it and let it sink in deeply.
Well, and great opera always lives with you after you walk out of the opera house. You know, you're thinking about it on the way home, and next morning at breakfast, you're still thinking about it.
Right. And I think the fact that John has chosen subjects which are so vital and connected to our lives is part of his opera's power. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's anything new historically either, because Nabucco certainly had relevance in Verdi's time.
This is very true. This is very true. I'd like to ask you a little bit about working with this particular cast, many of whom created the roles in San Francisco 2 years ago. Can you talk about some of them, and maybe some of the moments of the opera we ought to be looking for?
Well, they're some of my favorite singers in the world, and old friends, musical friends of mine, and so it's a joy to be with this cast. And they do own these roles, and it shows. It's very impressive and very beautiful. And I think musically, John has created music for each of them. In other words, they're defined, their personality, their character has musical profile from John's perspective too, which is wonderful.
I'm thinking of Gerald Finley, who will be singing Oppenheimer. Any particular moments?
There are many, but perhaps one of the most memorable is the end of Act One, which is it's a set piece. It's really an aria in old-fashioned sense. The text starts with "Batter my heart," and it's basically a tormented outpouring of emotion from him regarding the terror of the situation.
Batter my heart, weep as a
And it's very powerful. It has some allusions to Baroque opera somehow. It has this sense of being an old aria. Maybe it's because it's in D minor, you know, so it already has a...
And it is, it's a John, I think, John Donne sonnet. It's a metaphysical poet.
Right. And so musically this is captured as well. And that's a moment that I think is hard to forget.
Tell me a little bit about the difference between conducting a purely orchestral piece and conducting opera. You certainly do a lot of opera, and what are the difficulties, the differences?
Well, I guess the obvious one that makes conducting opera so wonderful is singers. I mean, it's so obvious as to make it seem almost silly to say it, but it is such a musically rewarding experience to conduct with singers, because they reconnect we instrumentalists or non-noise making musicians like conductors. They reconnect us with breath and with the lyricism that really is part of music making almost all the time. Of course, there are exceptional musical ideas, but that's really fundamental to musical experience, and to reconnect with them in that way is a great gift.
There's an element of being the traffic cop too, isn't there, just in terms of the logistics of getting through the evening?
Yes, often the air traffic control is much more complex in the pit than on a concert stage, and that's a challenge that's I find exhilarating to try and meet. And the other thing I love and have learned a great deal from doing opera is the sense of drama, the wedding of music to theater. And it's always fascinated with me how different composers of opera address the fact that musical time and theatrical time unfold differently. And musical time tends to be slower than theatrical time. And so it's always fascinating to see how composers address those issues. I mean, with Wagner, obviously, the drama all goes into musical time and is distended in that way. But in Debussy's Pelléas, he's trying to effectively set the play to music so that we're getting the dialogue at a similar rate of speed we would get as if it were being acted. Or Puccini playing the game of suspending time long enough for a 3-minute aria, but other times really propelling the drama forward. And of course, the old classic solution is to divide it between recitative and aria. But that issue is omnipresent in opera, of how to balance those two almost paradoxical needs in terms of time and how it unfolds.
I'm interested in your working with living composers. I know that some conductors say, oh, well, it's so wonderful because, you know, Beethoven is safely dead, or Mozart is safely dead. Don't have to worry about him coming back and talking about what he would do differently or what I should be doing. How do you work with living composers? And then also there's the whole element of working with the director. Where is the conductor in that?
Well, for me, the joy of working with living composers is I can get them on the phone or in the room, and I welcome their input. I learn so much in talking to them about what motivated this music that they created, and I'm not so sure Beethoven and Mozart are dead, and at least I feel haunted often when I'm trying to do their music.
And maybe the ghost is more difficult to deal with than the actual person.
Yeah, right. But it's that, because I feel my work is always to connect with the motivation of the composer. I think composers are often searching. I think it was Rabindranath Tagore, the Indian poet, who said that creation of art and literature and all of that is searching for that vibrating thing. And I loved that image because I think that's really what composers are doing, the good ones. They're searching for that vibrating thing, and they don't always know if they're achieving it or not. And they aren't always satisfied. And Beethoven's a great example of that, constantly wrestling to get what he actually produced to conform to that dim but real imaginative vision that was the beginning of the piece. So that, for me, is where I need to go in terms of trying to realize a piece of music of a composer, is to get into that vision of theirs. What did they want this to say? What does it mean? And that then leads to all the decisions about short and long and fast and slow. But I don't think any of those decisions can be made without knowing what they'll be serving in terms of content.
What about directors then? Do they sometimes get in the way?
With directors. Oh no, I'd love it. Because they bring, especially a director like Peter, they bring this world of perspective on what's going on in the piece especially directors who are as musically astute and sensitive and informed as Peter is, there's a kind of director who works from the score, and then there are the kind of directors who work independently of the score and sort of paste whatever concept they have onto the work. I've been fortunate not to have worked with many of them. I've had the good fortune of working with a lot of directors who really are in touch with the music and are in their work trying to do very much what I'm trying to do musically in terms of revealing the piece, allowing the piece to shine.
Do you have a feeling with this opera particularly, or maybe other Adams operas, that he's trying to get a message across, or is it simply telling a story and then the audience takes away whatever message they might be having?
I think the messages, if they're there, are sufficiently veiled that the works allow us to think for ourselves. I've never felt, in my own experience as a listener or an audience member, with Nixon or Klinghoffer or with Dr. Atomic, that I'm being told what to think, but rather that I'm being given material about which to think and then to come to my own conclusions.
I'm interested in the fact that you do work so much with living composers and certainly new opera. What do you think the future of opera is? Do you think opera is going to be with us 100 years from now in a form that we will recognize? Or
I think what's wonderful is we already have opera in forms that we wouldn't have recognized 50 years ago. I think that's very exciting.
Like what?
Like Dr. Atomic. For example, or Osvaldo Golioff's Passion, which for me is a kind of operatic event because it's theater and music. So I think it's already happening that opera is evolving in ways that I find it impossible to predict what will happen next, because I certainly couldn't have predicted what's already happened. And I find that to be exhilarating. I think opera is something that can't go away, won't. But will continue to evolve because it already has. And as any living thing, which opera should be, it needs to grow and change and evolve, and I think it will and certainly has.
I think sometimes audiences are a little nervous about coming to new opera. They aren't sure if they'll like it. They don't know if they know enough to understand it. Do you think that's a problem with Dr. Atomic? Do you think they should worry about that?
No. I hear similar comments often, even about orchestral concerts. And I've had a wonderful time in Atlanta. Just whoever I'm in contact with at the store or the coffee shop or the mall, if I'm conversing with them enough and I find out they've never been to a concert, I make sure and get them a ticket. And I don't prepare them in any way other than giving them a ticket. And invariably, these people that I've invited to come have had a fantastic time, and they want to come back, and they never realized what they were missing. And I've found that very gratifying. And I don't think opera or music or art or anything is for everyone. I think it's folly to think that music is going to be for everyone. But I think it's probably for a lot more people than realize how much enjoyment they could be getting out of it. And really, the only thing one needs to bring, in my mind, to appreciate opera or music is one's attention. And then let the work do its work. I think this art form does require the attentive perception of the listener, of the audience. But past that, I think our humanity is sufficient.
And I'm interested in what you would say to someone who's coming to Dr. Atomic. Why should you come to Dr. Atomic? What will you be able to get out of it?
I think what's so profound and important about this opera is the opportunity to contemplate our human situation in a world where we live with the ever-present possibility of nuclear disaster and Holocaust. And I think we need not to be in denial of that, which is difficult. I think most of us, I feel that I certainly avoid addressing that issue in my own mind because it's so overwhelming and so terrifying. But in fact, I think it is something we do need to wake up to, do need to try and find the difficult solutions and the difficult answers, because it's just too real a problem. And we're entering the seventh decade of living with nuclear weapons.
You were speaking, though, about the pacing of the opera, and I think there are some lighter moments, and I think particularly of the General Groves' little aria about his failed diets.
His diet. Yeah, that's a wonderful moment.
Poor man facing Armageddon and has decided he's going to worry about his waistband.
He's counting calories.
So we will come to the theater with open ears and see what we perceive, and probably something exciting.
Right.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.